Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the president who, instead of governing, is lashing out at an ESPN sportscaster, challenging his Secretary of State to an IQ test, and tweeting out a new round of insults against the Republican chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, referring to him as Little Bob Corker in a snide reference to Corker's height. Tim Naftali, a clinical professor of history and public policy at New York University, who was the first director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library and Museum, joins us to discuss his article at The Atlantic, The Problem with Trump's Madman Theory, and Corker's rejection of the notion that there is some kind of madman strategy akin to Nixon's behind Trump's belligerent threats against North Korea. We will also examine the historical record of the waning days of the Nixon administration regarding an impaired Nixon's access to the nuclear button compared to the concerns raised by Senator Corker that, quote, Trump may be setting us on a path to World War III. Then we'll assess the impact of the repeal of Obama's Clean Power Plan by the head of the EPA, who declared that the phony war on coal is over. David Freeman, who helped bring about the EPA, head of the TVA, New York Power, and the LADWP, and is the author of All Electric America, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future, and a new autobiography, The Green Cowboy, joins us. We will discuss the commonly held delusion that switching from coal to natural gas is a move in the right direction, and the need to immediately outlaw fossil fuels as poisons to the planet while rapidly converting to available clean solar and wind alternatives. Then finally, we'll examine the withdrawal of Kenya's opposition leader, Raila Odinga, from the rerun of the disputed August election overturned by Kenya's Supreme Court and scheduled for October the 26th. Kefa Otiso, a professor of geography and director of the Global Village at Bowling Green State University and the founding president of the U.S.-based Kenya Scholars and Studies Association, joins us to discuss the standoff between Odinga's followers who want election reforms instituted before a new election and the Kenyatta government who are treating Odinga's withdrawal as a concession instead of the protest that it is. And joining us now is Tim Naftali, who is a clinical professor of history and public policy at New York University. He was the first director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library and Museum and served as director of the Presidential Recordings Program at the Miller Center of Public Affairs. And he has an article at The Atlantic, The Problem with Trump's Madman Theory. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tim Naftali.
My pleasure, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Tim. And of course, the Madman Theory is the idea that Vietnam War, when President Nixon was absolutely furious with the North Vietnamese intransigence, he wanted to get a deal and wanted to get out of that war. He wanted to project the idea to them and the Russians and the Chinese that he was a madman and hated communism and was irrational and would possibly even drop a nuclear bomb as a way to get the North Koreans off the dime. And that, of course, has been applied to Donald Trump in his tweet storm against the North Koreans and his insults and threats before the United Nations that he would totally destroy the country. But that seems to have been undercut somewhat by Senator Corker in his interview with the New York Times, saying a lot of people think that there's some kind of good cop, bad cop act underway with North Korea, but that's just not true. So what do you make of Senator Corker's remarks?
Well, they are unprecedented. They're fascinating. They're a look behind the curtain at the Wizard of Oz. It's striking, but not surprising, that the foreign policy community, I'm not going to use the term establishment because it has partisan connotations, but the foreign policy establishment in Washington and throughout this country is appalled by the tension between what seems to be Secretary Tillerson's back-channel diplomacy and the president's tweet storms. There is a real sense, and I wrote this piece about Nixon's madman theory. He called it that. If anything, it was a strategy, and it didn't really apply it for very long. And I think more has been made of it than was the case at the time. But I wrote about it because unpredictability is a bad characteristic for an American president, because we have allies. And what allies need, understandably, is reliability. If you are relying on the United States for your security, or at least they're a United States part of your assessment of your security. You don't want an irrational, erratic American president. You want to be able to count on American support when and if it's necessary. Senator Corker's comments make clear that there is a struggle within the White House and the administration, and that most foreign policy experts are on one side and the president is on another. And that, in a sense, the concept of containment, which was applied, understandably, during the Cold War by the United States against the Soviet Union, now applies to explaining the relationship between the foreign policy community in Washington and the president. The community is trying to contain our president because his instincts are not very good in foreign policy.
And I guess the bottom line here is that attributing strategy to Trump is just far too generous. This is not strategy. This is a man that's impulsive, quixotic, mercurial, and strategy simply doesn't apply.
Well, if there is a strategy, it's an old New York developer strategy, basically raising the cost for the adversary and winning because the costs for them are much too high. It's the approach, apparently. You know, I'm not his biographer, but his biographers have noted that this is the approach that Donald Trump took as a developer. If somebody opposed him, Donald Trump would sue. Donald Trump would force that person to spend a lot of money on a legal defense, and the hope was they would give up. And I think, to the extent the man has a strategy, he's applying that to the world. And he doesn't realize that when existential questions are at issue, people will pay whatever it costs to stay in the game.
Well, in this case, you're dealing with nuclear-armed North Korea, and it seems that Donald Trump's actions and threats, both before the world body, the UN, where he said he would threaten to totally destroy this country, and his subsequent remarks that essentially they only understand one thing, which is military force. Isn't there a danger that could basically put Kim Jong-un in a position of use him or lose him, as they say in the nuclear parlance? In other words, he might feel compelled to preempt if he thinks, if he takes Donald Trump's words literally.
I couldn't put a percentage on that, but that's certainly a risk that the United States is taking. I just think the strategy can't work. Imagine if you have two people that are rattling their sabers. And, you know, let's make the argument that the North Koreans started first. So, but their saber is smaller than our saber. So they rattle their saber, and we rattle our much bigger saber. And we're thinking that by projecting the threat that we might use our saber, that they're going to give up their saber and be even more vulnerable to us. It makes absolutely no sense that this kind of unpredictable behavior would make them disarm. Why on earth would they make themselves more vulnerable to our power? So the strategy itself is bankrupt.
And again, I'm speaking with Tim Nefertali, who is a clinical professor of history and public policy at New York University. He was the first director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library Museum and served as director of the Presidential Recordings Program at the Miller Center of Public Affairs. And he has an article at The Atlantic, The Problem with Trump's Madman Theory. Well, I mean, there's been an unusually pregnant silence since the New York Times interview with Senator Corker and his response to Trump's attacks on him, tweeting out a series of insults, to which Senator Corker replied that the White House has become an adult daycare center, and apparently they missed their shift, implying that the adults around Trump, the generals, were absent, and he was able to tweet out. And of course, there's been this pregnant silence, and now it's been broken by Trump tweeting out today, "The failing New York Times set Little," that's spelled L-I-D-D-L-E, "Little Bob Corker up by recording his conversation was made to sound a fool, and that's what I am dealing with." This, of course, is along with attacking a sports anchor on ESPN and challenging Rex Tillerson to an IQ test. Do you have this feeling that Corker, when he suggested that we have a reality show in the Oval Office, a reality TV show in the Oval Office, that he may be onto something?
Well, I hope that, you know, when this presidency ends, whether it's in less than 4 or 4 years or 8 years, that we'll be able to go back to some decorum. And that's not because I have some great love or personal love for convention. It's that there is a reason why you want mutual respect. in the halls of government. You have to do deals. You have to respect each other. You have to try to respect each other. You have to trust that the other person will be a person of their word. If you start using social media to lambaste each other, it's hard for me to imagine that you can go and make deals and make the sausage, if you will, of legislation. So I think this is a terrible precedent. The president doesn't care, I think, because this is the world he inhabited before. This is the way he played out the game in New York. He used the tabloids largely to his advantage, and I think he assumes he can do the same in Washington. The question is, to what extent will Washington adapt to him? And what we're seeing more and more in is that Washington there's a limit to which Washington will go, and after that, they don't want to adapt. The leaks are not leaks by necessarily holdovers from the Obama years. The concerns are not from Democrats. They're coming from the president's own party, which means he has pushed many people beyond their limit in Washington. So the president has an approach. He is in the Oval Office. He believed he could win. No one else thought so, or maybe his family did, and he won, and therefore he has real self-confidence bordering on arrogance. Up to now, it hasn't worked as president. What has worked for him in the campaign has not worked at all as president. What we're going to watch is the extent to which he keeps trying and the extent to which Washington pushes back. At the moment, he is risking paralysis as president. I'm talking about legislative paralysis. And we'll see. Will he adapt or won't he? The Corker interview is important because it could be a pivot. Corker is saying apparently things that others in the Republican caucus would like to say, but they're afraid of Bannon. They're afraid of being primaried out. But they're still thinking this way.
Well, I recall when the Nixon tapes were made public, at that time, it's as though the scales fell off the eyes of the American body politic. People were just shocked by the language of President Nixon, cursing and cussing, etc. And, of course, this was not what he showed in public. And Nixon did act presidentially. He was perhaps one of the most prepared people for that job, and most people that get that job aren't prepared. So Nixon was unusually qualified and obviously took it seriously and understood that we have a different system in this country where our political leader is also the head of state. And as such, you expect a certain decorum from the head of state. How would you translate the lack of decorum from Donald Trump into the broader political landscape? He's got his core group of supporters, and clearly one of the reasons they elected him was that he was saying stuff that was so unconventional, but it resonated with them. So what's your sense of whether there's enough conservatives in this country who voted for him either because they hated Hillary Clinton or loved him? But I'm trying to get a handle on the breakdown between those that don't care about his lack of decorum, if not actually like his kind of rough and tumble, crude behavior, or whether or not you think there's a growing constituency in the middle, if you will, of people who simply feel that this is not how a president should behave.
Well, before I try to answer that, it's a tough one and it's a very good question. I'd like to just mention one thing about Nixon, which is that Nixon was quite self-disciplined. And he was unstable as a personality, but he tried very hard not to let people see it, except for his inner circle. I think he knew some of his views were wrong. He had them. He didn't change. But I think he knew he couldn't say this publicly. When I say his views, his anti-Semitism, his racism, his homophobia, I'm not sure the extent to which Donald Trump understands that some of his views are just wrong, that they are offensive. I'm not sure he understands or even cares. Richard Nixon at least understood that these views are offensive. It didn't stop him from having them. It just stopped him from sharing them. We're at a very interesting moment in American history. Since the rise of the Tea Party, but I would argue since the mid-90s with the contract with America, there has been a sharpening of the partisan divide in the United States. Now, will the president's behavior loosen the tribal loyalty of those on the Republican side of the divide? There are a number of Republicans who are questioning their own party. And George Will is the most famous, but others may be contemplating leaving the party. Are there enough of those to actually see a change in our two-party system? I don't know. That's what we're watching. Will the Republican Party just be the Trump Party? Or will there actually be a struggle for the soul of the Republican Party and the people who don't like the president's approach, who believe that a real conservative leader is what's required, that a moral leader is required? Will those people, do they constitute enough of a group, enough of a number, to form their own party or to take back the Republican Party? I don't know, but that's what we're watching right now. President Trump has basically thrown down the gauntlet for his own party. He's not reshaping the Democratic Party, although one could argue that some of his rhetoric boosted, you know, some of his rhetoric was similar to that of Sanders, not a lot, but some of it. But I think his big effect now is on the Republican Party. And what we're all watching now is the extent to which the party evolves or breaks apart or becomes truly just a Trump party. We'll see.
Well, back to Corker, he said that Trump may be setting the U.S. on a path to World War III, and he's clearly concerned. And the idea that the adults in the room, the generals, are supposed to contain him, or indeed, Corker said they spend a lot of time trying to contain him. And he said, and I don't think he appreciates that when the President of the United States speaks and says the things that he does, the impact that it has around the world, especially in the region that he's addressing. So I think it's pretty clear that Corker is alarmed, and the subtext surely is always, when you deal with this situation of a president, the ultimate power to destroy the world is there at his hand with the football. And we're often told, going back to Nixon's days, that Al Haig and Secretary of Defense Schlesinger put in a protocol to prevent Nixon from declaring or ordering a nuclear war if he was a little inebriated.
Well, that doesn't exist.
Exactly.
That didn't happen.
Right. We've told that, but it's been obviously mythologized. But we'll talk about that, and then compare that to what seems to be a very real situation we have today.
There are two elements to that, Ian. The first is that, as is clear in the authorized biography of Melvin Laird, and Melvin Laird cooperated with Dale Vannata, who wrote it. On a few occasions, the then Secretary of Defense, Mel Laird, did not implement orders that came from President Nixon late at night. The president had a hard time sleeping. I don't believe he had an alcohol problem, but he wasn't that coherent because of the sleeping pills he would take after he had one or two glasses of scotch. And at times he would call, apparently, and not be totally coherent. We don't have tapes of those calls because they were made on the telephone, from the telephone in the residence, and that was not part of the taping system. In any case, later on, with a different Secretary of Defense, in the last weeks of the administration in 1974, James Schlesinger, who was then Secretary of Defense, and he told this to the Nixon Library, and you can read the transcript, it's available. What he did was he made clear that the Pentagon Ops Center would not implement a military order unless it came directly from Richard Nixon. Knowing Nixon as well as he did, Schlesinger knew that Nixon would not order such a thing himself. Nixon preferred to act indirectly. That's why he wouldn't order a break-in. He wouldn't talk to G. Gordon Liddy and tell him to break into the Democratic National Headquarters. He would order it through other people. Nixon understood the importance of plausible deniability. So what James Schlesinger worried about was that one of Nixon's lieutenants would start moving troops around, that they wouldn't start a nuclear war, but that in order to show strength, they might mobilize some troops in the Washington area. I mean, there was no evidence they were planning to, but there was a concern. And so to be sure that this couldn't happen, the order to the Pentagon ops station was, unless you hear directly from the president, don't do what you're ordered to do, inform me. That was it. If President Nixon had called the ops center and ordered something, there was nothing they could do. They had to do it. So there wasn't a, if you will, the foreign policy community of the time was not able to stop Nixon directly, but they knew Nixon only worked indirectly. So this effect, this had an effect. I mean, as it turned out, no one in the White House attempted to order the movement of troops in those last days. But this was a bit of a hedging. This was an insurance policy. And that gives you a sense of how tense the atmosphere was in Washington in 1974, in August of 74.
Well, just in closing, Tim Naftali, then, you're making it clear, and it is unfortunately a fact, that there is no impediment between the president and the nuclear codes that's set up that way. So Donald Trump does actually have at his fingertips the ability to destroy not just the United States and Russia and China, but the whole world in effect. And this, I think, has some people concerned. I think it has Senator Corker concerned. Do you think that this should be a national debate?
Well, one of the things, there are two issues here. One is the fitness of the president, and there certainly should be a national discussion of that. And the other is whether the president of the United States should have the authority to launch nuclear weapons, and there's a reason why they do. First of all, they're commander-in-chief, and that's a constitutional duty. But secondly, in the event of war with the Soviets, for example, we wouldn't have very much time. And there wouldn't be the time to go to Congress, for example, and get a resolution. The Soviet attack would have occurred by then. And that's the reason why this was not debated during the Cold War. My understanding is that there still are some checks along the way. Now, no one's supposed to say no to the commander-in-chief, but it's not as if the president orders it and it just happens. There would be an opportunity, but it's not one that would take a long time, for somebody to intervene. But that would be an extra constitutional intervention. And I don't see how you could make that a legal requirement. You can't have both. You can't have the ability to react to a nuclear war and a long-drawn-out constitutional process for the use of the button. Our problem right now is that we are concerned about the fitness of our president. It's one of the glitches in the constitutional system that we have. We can end up with an unfit president. And I think what Corker has raised is the very important issue of whether or not President Trump is fit to be commander-in-chief. And that's what should be discussed.
Well, Tim Naftali, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Tim Naftali, who's a clinical professor of history and public policy at New York University. He was the first director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library and Museum and served as director of the Presidential Recordings Program at the Miller Center of Public Affairs. And he has an article at The Atlantic, The Problem with Trump's Madman Theory. We're going to take a brief station break and back assessing the impact of the repeal of Obama's Clean Power Plan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Freeman, a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under President Carter, and also headed New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the California State Energy Czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and Company. Now a senior advisor to Friends of the Earth, he is the author of All Electric America, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future, and he has a new autobiography, The Green Cowboy. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Freeman.
Well, thank you for having me.
And today, in declaring an end to the war on coal, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt, signed a measure to repeal President Obama's signature Clean Power Plan. And that, of course, is being seen as a great setback following President Trump's pulling out of the Paris Accords. How significant do you see this move on the part of Scott Pruitt? And, of course, the war on coal has been largely an invention of the Trump campaign itself.
Now, there's been no war on coal, and Mr. Pruitt is a present and clear danger to the environment rather than a protector. So we all know all that. But I think the more important lesson and issue here is that the Democratic Party and the good people of America need to take the offense here. I mean, yes, we have a president and an administration and a Congress that, in Harry Truman's word, can give them the best possible ratings. You can call them a do-nothing Congress. But focusing on what they're not doing and what Scott Pruitt is doing is missing the point. The point is that we don't have an offense. There is no environmental movement in this country anymore. There was in the 70s, in the 80s, and even into the 90s. But bellyaching about Trump is not going to save the environment. We've got to do something. And there are activists at the state and local level that are trying to do something. But we're not doing enough, and we're not talking in plain English. I mean, the program that Scott Pruitt has dismantled, the so-called Clean Power Program, was attempting to deal with just one-third of the greenhouse gases, and they were dealing with it in a very mild manner, to put it mildly. In other words, they were suggesting reductions in carbon emissions that were already taking place in the marketplace because natural gas is cheaper than coal, and the so-called war on coal was just something that was happening in the marketplace. But don't get too excited. It wasn't really helping prevent climate change, because natural gas, while the carbon content is only half of coal, it is methane, and it leaks. And that methane is 80 times as bad as carbon for at least 20 years, and then it lingers on. So that if the leakage is 1 or 2%, which it is, natural gas is as bad as coal. So Obama was largely ignoring two-thirds of the problem, the emissions from automobiles and heating homes and factories, and in the one-third, the electric power industry, he was simply mimicking what was happening in the marketplace. And his Clean Power Program, frankly, if it were implemented, wouldn't be making a whole hell of a lot of difference. Now, at least in California, we realize that what it takes is mandates. I mean, let me put it this way. It doesn't take a lot of brain power to figure out that if this stuff is poison, and it's poisoning the environment in a way that it's creating a greenhouse that's so strong that it's causing the oceans to rise and the hurricanes to be worse, that we ought to stop burning fossil fuels. We ought to at least stop building new power plants that use fossil fuels. So why didn't Obama propose even a one-sentence bill that said all new power plants shall be zero emission? And don't get me wrong, the initiatives in energy efficiency have been somewhat helpful. But to say it, and I as a staff person helped enact the CAFE standards, they moved the cars from 12 miles per gallon to 20-something. But we have so many more cars now, and we drive them so many more miles, that we burned about as much gasoline last year as we ever have. So basically, we have not even proposed laws at a national level that would make a difference. And so I kind of view the good guys as that believe in climate as intelligent deniers, whereas the Trumpers are just don't believe the science. But Mother Nature doesn't see any difference. We're all polluting in a very, very vigorous way. And but there is hope. The technology has advanced so rapidly that solar and wind is now cheaper. And what we need to do is just pass laws that require that everything new be zero emission. And the big, big, big new news is the Chinese government is considering doing just that. And hopefully California and many other states will follow. So this fight is not over, but we need to be playing offense and not sitting around just bellyaching about what Trump's not doing.
And again, I'm speaking with David Freeman, a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He's had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under President Carter and also headed New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and Company. Now a senior advisor to Friends of the Earth, he's the author of All Electric America, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future, and he has a new autobiography, The Green Cowboy. Now, I was actually watching on CBS News last night a piece they did on China and how China is building just acres and acres of solar farms, some of them are floating on lakes. Extraordinary statistics of how much solar power they install every day. And, of course, they've mandated a move to electric cars. Still, of course, the electricity itself is coming from coal plants, which they are phasing out. And they seem to be setting an example here. So why don't we have a sort of Sputnik moment? Remember when the Soviets put up Sputnik? There was a tremendous backlash, and it spurred NASA into action, and JFK made the promise of putting a man on the moon and bringing him back to Earth, and the rest is history. What's it going to take in the U.S. for us to have a Sputnik moment on the dangers of global warming and the need for clean power?
I think that we need a young female version of Ralph Nader to somehow appear. I think the makings are there for a giant step forward. And California has shown some signs of getting there. You know, this fight's not over. You know, I have 9 grandchildren, and I'm just looking for somebody to give them something worth fighting for. I mean, the Clean Power Program, frankly, would not make enough difference to where it would save us. I mean, you know, when we had a problem with DDT, we called it poison, and we outlawed it. Now, you can't get up and make a speech saying that climate is the most awesome challenge this world has ever faced and really believe it, and then suggest pablum or patty cake. I mean, we just need to start getting our leaders, at least on the Democratic side, to propose laws that will make a difference. Now, in California, that's beginning to happen. We now have got renewable energy laws requiring that at least half of the electricity be a zero emission. And a bill to make it 100% almost passed. Hopefully it will pass next year. But that's just dealing with the making of electricity. The big thing that we're not doing is in using that electricity to replace oil and gas. When is anybody going to have the courage to get up and say that in order to save the planet, we've got to put the oil and gas people out of business over the next 30 years? 1 year at a time, we have to reduce about 4% a year. It can be done if we decided to do it and then enacted laws. And the beautiful thing is that the technology is there to make it happen. The electric cars are now a commercial product And if they were mass-produced, their costs would come down, and they would be the cheapest car on the road because they don't have any maintenance costs to speak of, and the electricity is equivalent of about 50 to 75 cents a gallon gasoline, and it has no moving parts but the wheels, so there's not a lot of maintenance. We've got technology that's actually better, but we have an oil and gas and nuclear lobby that's trying to hold on to the past, and it requires laws to change that. We wouldn't have seatbelts in cars if we hadn't passed a law to require them. I mean, here the life of the planet is at stake, and it would seem to me that we would pass the laws, and I think that we have a lot of cities now and states that are saying they want to go to 100% renewable. But then they've got to be sure that they are coming up with programs to make it happen, and that we give the automobile industry, they're saying they can make electric cars. Well, tell them that as of 2025, all their cars have to be electric. That's what China is going to do, and we got to do the same. And the same with new houses. And we can provide tax incentives to enable people to retrofit their homes to get off of burning fossil fuels. We need to use the word poison when we talk about fossil fuels, all of them. And natural gas, which is methane, is as bad as coal, and we need to start lumping them together and not feel like we're doing something really wonderful. If we substitute natural gas for coal, where Mother Nature doesn't know the difference.
Well, when you say we should be calling oil and gas poison, that brings up the obvious case of cigarettes, which eventually we decided were poison and a health hazard, and we tax them, and we've taxed them heavily and continue to tax them, and the revenues are used to treat people who have suffered as a result.
Yeah, but there's a fundamental difference.
Mm-hmm.
If you smoke, you die.
Right.
Now, I realize that a non-smoker was affected by smoke from a smoker, but by and large, the damage was to you. On the climate issue, we are all roommates, my friend.
Right.
And if you drive an electric car and I drive a gas guzzler, we're both going to cook. So if there was anything that required a mandate for everybody to do it, it's the climate issue. So it's not good enough to just tax people, because the rich will pay the tax and keep on polluting. I mean, to tell people that they have to pay to pollute might help a little bit if the problem weren't as dire as the climatologists tell us. But we need to outlaw this stuff because it is poison.
But if you outlaw gasoline and don't have a substitute, I mean, isn't that...
But we do. But we do.
We do, but it's not there. I mean, they keep promising stuff and it never arrives. So how do you get your local gas station out of business?
Well, in the 70s, when we had a Republican president and we had an EPA headed by Mr. Ruckelshaus, the electric power industry said, we don't know how to make a scrubber to scrub the dirt out when you burn coal. It's a local pollution problem. He ordered them to do it because he knew that the technology was available. We have a rule under EPA that you have to use the best available technology, and the cost comes down with mass production. And the EPA in the 70s ordered the utilities to build scrubbers, and they built the scrubbers, and we don't have the smog that we had then. We still have the carbon going up, but we've kind of improved the local pollution. So, frankly, the electric cars are a commercial reality, and with mass production, their costs will come down. They're inherently a lower-cost car, and the heat pumps are a commercial item. We could have an all-electric America with all electricity made from solar in 30 years, if we started doing it and started going there. I'm not advocating that we turn the lights out or that this be done overnight. I'm saying that if we don't start now, the climatologists tell us that we've got to get this done over the next 30 years. Well, every year that we delay it, it becomes harder and harder to do, and more gas is piled up. I'm trying to eject a sense of urgency into instead of just kicking the can down the road. I mean, let's be very honest about it. It doesn't take a lot of political courage for the President of the United States to go to Paris and sign a non-binding treaty that says that we're going to try real hard by 2040 or 2050 to come clean and come back home and actually do nothing in 2017 and 18 that really moves us in that direction, except a little bit on the electric side. So what I'm saying is we don't have a lot to brag about. We ought to just assume that Trump is doing nothing, the federal government is doing nothing, and focus on putting together something to fight for so that this becomes a critical issue in the national election in 2020. And in the meantime, we get as many states and cities to go in that direction. But that's what we ought to be doing rather than bellyaching about Trump.
Well, David Freeman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. And I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, thank
Bye-bye.
You, Dave. Bye-bye, Dave. And again, I've been speaking with David Freeman, who's a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He's had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under President Carter and also headed New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and Company. Now a senior advisor to Friends of the Earth, he's the author of All Electric America, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future, and he has a new autobiography, The Green Cowboy. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining the withdrawal of Kenya's opposition leader, Raila Odinga, from the rerun of the disputed August election overturned by Kenya's Supreme Court.
In the sacred land, it has seen many hands, it has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old, and now the greedy souls just don't care to know of the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud, and if you love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds, cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will confront.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kefa Ratiso, who is a professor of geography and director of the Global Village at Bowling Green State University. He's also the founding president of the U.S.-based Kenya Scholars and Studies Association and co-author of Population Geography, Problems, Concepts, and Prospects, and is the author of Culture and Customs of Tanzania. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kefa Ratiso.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you much. Yeah.
So, Kefa, what do you make of this sudden withdrawal by the opposition leader in Kenya, Raila Odinga, who pulled out of the elections that are supposed to take place on October the 26th after the original elections that took place back in August were ruled by Kenya's Supreme Court to be, I can't imagine what the ruling says, but basically they invalidated the August vote, which Kenyatta was supposed to have won by 54% compared to Odinga's 44%. So there's a lot of confusion. Can you clarify it?
Yeah, there's actually, yes, quite a lot of confusion in the country. Some people suggest that now then that clears the table, basically, for Mr. Kenyatta's declaration as president. But I think in pulling out, there are a number of confusing clauses in the Constitution. And when they had this, something very close to a contested presidential election in 2013, the court ended up ruling that in a situation like this, you almost need to have fresh nominations and fresh elections. And the reason Raila basically withdrew is because he figured that the minimum changes that he was requesting to be made at the country's electoral agency that would make the elections more transparent as far as he's concerned had not been effected. Therefore, there was no point in him continuing to participate in the process.
Well, but he refused to accept Arua Kenyatta's victory right back in August.
Yes.
So it's very hard to understand why he would have made such a strong stand and then it appearing at the last minute to sort of withdraw. And did he offer a replacement, or is he basically saying we have to go back to essentially, you know, what we'd call in the U.S. conducting primaries?
Pretty much that is what it looks like it may need to happen, because I think that he does seem to have a legitimate reason for what he has done, because the Supreme Court's nullification of the August 8 election was basically on the basis of a flawed process. So a number of things that had not been done right. And on that basis, Mr. Odinga ended up requesting that those things be fixed before the next elections are done. Now, some of them, understandably, may actually end up taking a little bit more time than the country has. But at the same time, you can almost see that what he's fearing is that if the elections are held without fundamental changes at the country's electoral agency, you'll end up pretty much having a repeat of the August 8 elections that, as far as he's concerned, were flawed in terms of the process. So in many ways, he's basically trying to force the agency and actually, if anything, buy time for the minimum changes that he wants at the electoral agency to be conducted. Now, obviously, it does create a little bit of uncertainty for the country.
Well, what were the basis of the rulings? In their ruling, did the Supreme Court outline what went wrong, and therefore you would have a kind of sense of what reforms are needed?
Yeah, actually, the Supreme Court did lay out a number of things that went wrong, including the transmission of the vote. Ironically, there isn't much debate on whether the elections were conducted well. The voting itself was conducted well. It seems like the problem set in when the votes from the tallying from the voting centers were being transmitted to the national center. And according to the current rules, when the votes are counted at the constituency level, for example, there is an electronic gadget that sends in the numbers, the number of votes that each person gained. But at the same time, the same gadget is supposed also to send a scanned copy of the results declaration form, and the form is also supposed to have a serial number and a number of other security features. So apparently, for whatever reason, these votes were not transmitted as stipulated in the Constitution. Some of the forms are said to not have had the security features. Some of them are said to have been photocopied. Some of them are said to not have been signed. So in the end, Mr. Odinga questions the credibility of the numbers that were showing up at the national level, even on national television, and which actually even the electoral agency was forced to concede in court that they were not really the results, but that they couldn't tell anybody what the numbers were if in fact they were not results of the vote. So really it's more of a procedural thing. The process was violated somewhere, and Mr. Odinga is not clear that it's not convinced that actually some of those procedural things have been actually fixed. So the court, in short, did actually rule in terms of what needed to be done, but apparently those changes have not been done, have not been implemented.
And again, I'm speaking with Kefa Otiso, who is a professor of geography and director of the Global Village at Bowling Green State University. He's also the founding president of the US-based Kenya Scholars and Studies Association. So there was, of course, instability in the previous elections and a lot of bloodshed, and there was a lot of tension in the current elections. So give us a sense of what the battle lines, if you will, are in terms of politics and tribal affiliations.
Yeah, there were some unfortunate incidences of loss of life in the last election, which actually led to a lot of the changes that were effected at the electoral agency, which were supposed to be tested for the first time this time around, and which to some degree worked, except for the step of electronically transmitting the results. So Mr. Odinga is from the Luo community, and he's allied with people from other communities like the Kampas and the Luyas. And then Mr. Kenyatta is from the dominant Kikuyu community in terms of numbers, particularly being the largest ethnic community. And also Mr. Ruto is from, the vice president is from the Kalenjin community, which actually is a colonial creation, because that community never existed until the colonial era. It is actually an amalgamation of a number of communities in the Rift Valley province of the country. But because the two leaders that are the vice president and the president were subjected to ICC proceedings after the last election, I don't think there is an appetite in the country on the part of any leading politician to actually plunge the country into chaos, because there might be a prospect of them also being charged at the ICC. So in some ways, I also have to say that I think that the country has matured quite a bit. The fact that, in fact, we have come this far after the August elections without much political issues and even without much skirmishes, as it were, it would suggest to me that the country's institutions are robust enough significantly to be able to handle some of the challenges they are going through. Remember, we are where we are because the Supreme Court ended up basically exercising its powers in nullifying the presidential election for the first time in the country's history. And so you're beginning to see each of the three branches of government beginning to, in more ways than one, actually play its role. So I do believe that the institutions are capable. I mean, it's a challenging time. I'm not going to sugarcoat it for the country. But at the same time, I think that there is significant capacity, despite the noise, to be able to handle some of the changes that are required. Going forward, I think what everybody is waiting for is basically what the IEBC, which is actually the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, is going to say about this particular step that Mr. Odinga has taken. And from that ruling, I think then people will know how best to go forward. But I do think that the prospect of violence is substantially reduced, although there is quite a bit of tension.
So refresh our memory, if you will, Kefere Otiso, about the International Criminal Court weighing in and having the head of state, Uru Kenyatta, basically named in an indictment, from what I recall.
Yeah. This happened after the last election, the run-up to the last elections, when people were killed, and then the current president and the vice president were accused of having fund the ISIS, having fund some of the political fights that actually led to a loss of life in the country. But as you know, for any number of reasons, the courts they ended up pretty much acquitting them. But the process was, in one way or another, quite significant in terms of disciplining the country's political class, because before then, I don't think anybody in the country, either domestically or internationally, had ever been in some ways even indicted for any of that type of behavior. So it did actually help in terms of disciplining the political class a little bit, and I don't really think that the country has an appetite, even the leaders have an appetite for going down that route. The people are more informed. There's been a lot of peace messaging to make sure that citizens don't go fighting each other because of politicians, and the politicians themselves have ended up being a little bit more disciplined than they were before the 2013 elections.
So what was the role then of Cambridge Analytica, the British-based company owned by the billionaire Robert Mercer, who is the funds Stephen Bannon's Operation Breitbart and is the biggest donor to Donald Trump? They were involved in Brexit, and they were obviously involved in the Trump election, in the digital side of Trump's election. And now, apparently, they've been involved in the Kenyan elections, which the Supreme Court voided. You mentioning the irregularities between the vote itself and the transmissions and the transmission from local precincts to the central counting facility, where there was a clear malpractice. Do you have any information for us on the role of Cambridge Analytica? How they were involved in the election?
No, other than seeing one or two sentences in the press that they were involved, I haven't really seen anything that specifically says what they were supposed to do. I remember seeing something along the lines of fine-tuning sort of a social media messaging of Mr. Kenyatta, but beyond that, I haven't really seen anything that specifically said what exactly they did. And quite frankly, I'm not even sure necessarily that they were, whether they necessarily changed the election in one way or the other, because quite frankly, it looks like if you look at the way the major, you know, ethnic communities ended up, you know, sort of ganging up in these elections behind the two main presidential leaders, I would say were the larger determining factors. So each of the two have been running about numbers. For example, Mr. Kenyatta talking about the numbers behind his Kikuyu community, which is one of the largest in the country, and the vice president also bringing in the larger Kalenjin community, and then Mr. Raila bringing in his Luo community and some of his lieutenants bringing in the Luya community as well as the Kamba community. So it seems to me that those ethnic numbers were perhaps more influential, but as I said, I haven't really seen something specifically that goes beyond one or two sentences that I saw in the media in terms of the role of that organization.
Well, just in closing, Kefa Rotiso, is there a way out? You've got the vice president saying the fact that the opposition leader withdrew means we won, and the opposition leader saying no, I'm withdrawing because I want the reforms that the Supreme Court announced when they cancelled or overturned the elections to be implemented, and so it looks like a standoff.
No, there is a standoff, and I think the main issue going forward is what the electoral agency is going to say tomorrow in terms of its reading of the law. If it reads it along the lines of the vice president, then obviously they might end up proceeding to swear the current president. But there's also some sections of the constitution that suggest that it may actually require a new poll entirely in 90 days. So the issue is going to be how they read that particular law. But what I can tell you is that in the event that they decide to swear in the incumbent and basically proceed along those lines, it is going to create a situation where the government will actually have a legitimacy crisis. Of course, they would say we won and Mr. Raila withdrew. But really, in terms of thinking of the long-term welfare of the country, I think it's better for these two gentlemen to sit down and come up with a more amenable solution, because it's one of those things where you might win the battle and not necessarily win the war. And I think in terms of legitimacy and long-term good of the country, they're probably better off sitting down and actually talking on the way forward.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Kefa Rotiso.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Kefa Rotiso, who's a professor of geography and director of the Global Village at Bowling Green State University. He's also the founding president of the US-based Kenya Scholars and Studies Association. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.